This is Ni'ima Novetsky from AlaTorah.org. In honor of Rosh Chodesh Adar and the upcoming holiday of Purim, this Torah cast will explore the story of Megillat Esther. Many of us come to the Megillah with certain preconceived portraits, perhaps even caricatures, of its characters in our minds. The beautiful Queen Esther, the wise and righteous Mordechai, the evil Haman, and the drunken, foolish King Ahasuerus. A careful reading of the Megillah, however, allows for multiple interpretations of each of these figures, and therefore of the story as a whole. Today we will focus on the character of Ahasuerus, questioning if he really is a fickle fool as he is so often portrayed. Our starting point will be the opening of chapter 7, one of the most pivotal scenes in the Megillah, when Esther reveals her identity and pleads for her life. Ahasuerus and Haman join Esther for her second banquet, and the king asks Esther if there's anything she wants to request of him. She responds, "Tinatin li nafshi b'she'elati v'ami b'vakashati. Let my life be given to me at my petition, and my people at my request. Ki nimkarnu ani v'ami lahashmid, laharog, ula'abed. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, slain, and exterminated. V'ilu la'avadim v'lishfachot nimkarnu, hecharashti, ke'ein hatzar shoveh b'nezeh kamelech. Had we only been sold as slaves and maidservants, I would have been quiet, for the adversary is not worthy of the king's loss." Ahasuerus reacts with shock and fury, asking, "Mihu zeh ve'izehu? Who is the person who dared conceive of such a plan?" When Esther points to Haman, the king leaves the room in a rage, returns to find Haman begging for his life on Esther's couch, and orders Haman's hanging. Ahasuerus's surprise and incensed reaction is somewhat unexpected. How could he not have known that Haman was responsible for the plan? After all, had not Ahasuerus given his approval for it only a few days earlier? And even if at the time he had not been aware that Esther was a potential victim, he still should have now realized that Haman was the plan's architect. Moreover, considering that he himself had acquiesced to the plan, why is he so furious at Haman? And if Ahasuerus is upset merely because Esther would be included in the planned decimation, one would have thought that he and Haman could have figured out a way to exempt the queen, thereby fixing the problem. A second set of questions relates to Esther's plea and tactics. If she wanted to beg the king to spare her and her nation's lives, why do so at a party to which she has also invited Haman? Moreover, although the king might have a personal interest in keeping her alive, if he truly wanted to annihilate the Jewish people, why does she think that he will reverse the edict rather than simply issue a special royal dispensation for her? Finally, why does she mention the potential alternative of being sold into slavery? How does this strengthen her argument? One other episode in the Megillah is relevant to our discussion: Haman's original request to annihilate the Jewish nation. In chapter 3, Haman tells the king that there is a certain nation whose laws differ from the other nations in the empire, and who do not keep the king's laws. As such, it is best that the king destroy them. Haman then offers 10,000 silver talents to be brought to the king's treasury. The king not only agrees to the plan, but hands over his signet ring to Haman, apparently giving him free rein to do as he pleases. Several aspects of Haman's request are perplexing. First, Haman never explicitly mentions the Jewish nation by name. Was it obvious about whom he was speaking, or is it possible that Ahasuerus was unaware? Second, Haman gives only a one-sentence explanation of why the king should kill off the nation, speaking of how it differs from others and does not abide by the king's laws. Was this really sufficient to lead the king to approve of a plan to exterminate an entire nation? Finally, how should Haman's monetary offer be understood? Is this a bribe to the king, a portion of the expected spoils, or compensation for the loss of tax revenues? Commentators explore these questions, reaching very different conclusions about the dynamic between Haman, Ahasuerus, and Esther, and also drawing diametrically opposed portraits of the king himself. A first and simple approach to our story, taken by Rabban Gamliel in Bavli Megillah, assumes, like many readers of the Megillah, that Ahasuerus was a foolish and fickle king. He had previously known of Haman's plan to annihilate the Jews, but being a dim-witted drunkard, he did not immediately make the connection between it and the threat to Esther's life. According to this approach, Haman was upfront when discussing his plan to annihilate the Jewish people, and despite the silence in the text, Ahasuerus knew from the beginning to which nation Haman was referring and what he wanted to do with them. Knowing the king's shallow nature, Haman did not spend much time explaining his reasoning, and instead bribed Ahasuerus, assuming that he would be swayed more by riches than by principles. Ahasuerus was in fact swayed, and not being particularly adept at governing on his own, was only too happy to hand over his ring and the necessary powers to Haman. He let him do as he pleased, not overly concerned with the details, and as such, the entire matter easily slipped out of his mind, not to be thought of again until the party. The verses highlight that as the edict went out, Haman and the king drank to it, perhaps suggesting that even while discussing the issue, Ahasuerus was not totally sober. The repeated mention of drinking throughout the story adds to the portrait of a drunkard who hardly remains sober long enough to process what is going on in his kingdom. The fact that just days after signing an edict to exterminate the Jewish nation, Ahasuerus showers honor on Mordechai, a Jew, without any show of discomfort about the hypocrisy of his actions, is further proof of the king's fickle nature and out-of-sight, out-of-mind attitude. Esther is just as aware as Haman of the king's nature and plans her revelation and plea accordingly. She purposefully chooses a non-threatening and intimate setting, a party at which Ahasuerus will have plenty to drink, knowing that matters of state will not be at the forefront of the king's mind and that she will thus be able to maximize Ahasuerus's surprise. Moreover, she ensures that Haman is present so that the king will take out his wrath immediately before once again changing his mind. Her plan works and Ahasuerus is enraged. Even so, though, it's possible that on his own, Ahasuerus might not have insisted on the hanging of Haman. It was only Harvona's words which put the thought into his head, and as was often the case, on the spur of the moment, he decided to act. This position paints an unflattering portrait of the king, but it considers him to be more inept, foolish, and fickle than actively wicked. A second reading of our story, taken by the 15th century Spanish commentator Rav Yitzchak Arama, presents a very different Ahasuerus. He suggests that he was not an inept, drunken ruler, but a capable one, who erred only in putting his trust in the wrong man. According to this approach, Ahasuerus had been deceived by Haman, who had both hidden the identity of the nation he was intent on destroying and misled him regarding what he planned to do to that nation. As such, it was only after Esther pointed to Haman as the source of danger that Ahasuerus first became aware that Haman had been plotting to annihilate the Jews. Rav Arama points out that when Haman petitions the king to approve his plan, he never names the particular nation to be punished, but refers to merely a generic Am Echad. He further misleads the king concerning the punishment to be wrought, purposefully choosing a word La'abed, or its Persian equivalent, which was ambiguous in meaning, so the king would not know that he planned to decimate the rebellious nation. He instead hoped that Ahasuerus would think that he was planning on merely enslaving them. Only in the official letters to the various states did Haman disambiguate, adding La'ashmid, La'harog, U'la'abed, that he planned to destroy and kill. According to this reading, when Haman speaks of placing 10,000 silver talents in the treasury, he might be referring to the profits from the sales of the people as slaves. Ahasuerus, trusting his right-hand man, did not ask any questions and simply gave him his rubber stamp without being aware that it was the Jewish people Haman sought to harm. This was not a sign of incompetence, but rather a necessity when ruling an empire. One sometimes has no choice but to delegate responsibility and trust one's advisors. The king and Haman then drink to sign the deal. Again, this is not evidence of insobriety, but rather merely standard procedure when signing an agreement. Why, though, wasn't Haman simply upfront? This approach would respond that Ahasuerus was actually positively disposed to the Jews of his empire, as proven by his honoring of Mordechai. As such, he would never have agreed to the plan had he known the identity of the nation. Rav Arama even suggests that Ahasuerus knew all along that Esther was Jewish. He simply did not know that Haman's edict referred to Jews. Esther perhaps only hid her identity until becoming queen, but not afterwards. As support for his hypothesis, Rav Arama notes that Esther, when pleading for her life, never explicitly mentioned her nationality. In addition, Ahasuerus' surprise is not over Esther's identity, but about who could have proposed such a plan. Esther, for her part, is aware not only of Haman's full plan, but also of his deception to the king, and uses this against him. She not only reveals his plan, but tells the king, "V'ilu lavadim v'lishvachot nimkarnu hecharashti," to create a rift between Ahasuerus and Haman, suggesting that one was in the right and the other wrong. She asks if she is innocently suggesting that if the only wrong done had been to sell her nation into slavery, as Ahasuerus had intended, she would not have troubled the king. But when the stakes are life and death, as per Haman's deception, she can no longer remain silent. According to this approach, it's possible that Ahasuerus hangs Haman, since this was the standard punishment for treason against the king, and Haman was deemed as having rebelled since he veered from Ahasuerus's desired edict. Rav Aram's Ahasuerus, then, is a positive figure who honored the Jewish nation and was innocent of any intent to kill them. Professor Barry Walfish, in his book Esther in Medieval Garb, suggests that Rav Arama, like many medieval Spanish exegetes, went out of his way to defend the king because of the ideal of the gracious king which was so prevalent in certain circles of Spanish Jewry. He points out that the Jewish courtier class had a special relationship with the monarchy, viewing themselves as indispensable to their rulers, and as such, could not fathom that a king would possibly want to annihilate the Jewish nation. If a king did indeed suggest some harm, it could have been due only to bad counsel. This attitude was read back into the story of the Book of Esther as well. A third approach to our story paints a portrait of Ahasuerus which is somewhere in between that of Rav Arama and that of Rabban Gamliel. The king is not a fickle fool, but not an ardent admirer of the Jewish nation either. According to this approach, Haman had been upfront with the king, and so Ahasuerus was fully aware both of the identity of the nation he wanted to destroy and his desire for their destruction. As such, when Esther made her plea, he understood immediately that she was referring to Haman's plan. He only pretended to be unaware because intervening events had caused him to mistrust Haman, and he wanted to use the opportunity to eliminate him. This approach assumes that Ahasuerus was in full agreement with Haman when the edict was issued. He had no love for the Jews, and when he honored Mordechai, he was likely unaware of his Jewish lineage. Even learning of Esther's Jewish identity would not on its own have made him reverse the edict. Had he so desired, he would have simply exempted her from the destruction. However, the night before the party, Haman had advised the king that the one the king desired to honor be robed in the king's garment and ride on the royal horse. Ahasuerus interpreted these words as evidence of Haman's aspirations to become king himself and began to look for ways to eliminate him. Esther's plea, then, played right into his hands. Ahasuerus takes the opportunity to feign shock at her words so that he can use the opportunity to eliminate Haman. Esther, for her part, encourages the king's mistrust of Haman by trying to make Ahasuerus jealous of his advisor. Rather than make an intimate party for merely herself and the king, she invites Haman as a third wheel. Haman's falling on her bed to plead for his life played perfectly into her plan. It reinforced Ahasuerus's previous concerns, leading to the conclusion that Haman was actively rebelling, desiring both the crown and the queen. When Harvona reveals that Haman had planned to kill Mordechai, a person who had proven his loyalty by saving the king's life, Ahasuerus's suspicions that Haman is a traitor are further confirmed, and Haman is hanged, the punishment of choice for treason. According to this position, then, Ahasuerus was politically motivated, fully alert to the goings-on in his kingdom, and ready to remove all potential threats to his throne. It is Haman's insatiable desire for glory more than anything else that saves the people. To summarize, commentators have explained Ahasuerus's reaction to Esther's plea in very different ways. Some assume that his shock is simply the result of his capricious nature and his only dim awareness of the goings-on in his own kingdom. Others posit that he was misled by Haman and that he first understood only now that the Jewish nation was to be annihilated. A final approach asserts that Ahasuerus's surprise was only feigned and that he was simply trying to make the most of the opportunity to punish Haman for other deeds. The various positions lead to very distinct portraits of the king: a fickle drunkard, a capable monarch, an admirer of the Jews, or a shrewd but opportunistic despot. Which portrait is most supported by the text, and how does each affect the overall message of the Megillah? Is the story about the challenges of life in exile, about living under the whims of a capricious or perhaps despotic ruler? Or is it a story about trust and in whom to put your trust? Perhaps both readings lead to the same ultimate message. Tov lachasot b'Hashem mipto'ach ba'adam. It is better to take refuge in Hashem than to trust in man. For more on this topic and other topics related to Megillat Esther, please visit alatorah.org.